Greetings, everyone. I wanted to mention to you that Adriel Mirto called me at my home day before yesterday at about 2 p.m. Thursday, our time, which would have been about 3 a.m. Friday morning, their time, in the Philippines. Mr. Mirto died after about a 15-day illness of failure of several of the vital organs, kidney failure, liver failure, and several other things that were wrong. We'll find out a little later on when Adriel gives us the details by telefax. Adriel, who is 26, is an extremely well-educated young man, has two businesses over there, one of which is very successful in telecommunications. He was the one who was doing a lot of the legwork for his father, Pike, who I believe was in about his mid-50s, and I'm not really certain of that age, but I'll get it to you later in the international news or in our publications. When we originally had to curtail Watch Magazine because of budgetary constraints here, Mr. Mirto would take articles from several of our international news publications or back issues of Watch, and he would then have them reprinted in low-cost magazine style for the evangelistic outreach program in the Philippines. Actually, his son Adriel was the one who was doing all of the legwork and doing all of that. A group of the church members there actually bought a small printing press so they could print articles and distribute them locally, and also his letters and other publications. I'm very, very well impressed with his son, who has offered to stand in and to do everything that he's been doing and to fill in the gap that is being left by his father, which is going to be very difficult because Adriel is not a minister and doesn't really want to be. But there is another gentleman over there that was being recommended for ordination, which I'm going to interview and talk to when I'm over there, and also look at what Mr. Mirto left behind relative to this gentleman. If I've ever seen a classic example where the clear difference between the Church of God International and the Evangelistic Association should be highlighted, it's in the case of the Philippines, because with more than 1,000 plus islands and very great distances between Mindanao and the islands of Leyte and Luzon and the other islands there, and with the Bisayan province and with Cagayan del Oro and down in the south, Zamboanga del Norte, with churches all over the islands, very, very difficult to have any cohesion. For some years, I had voiced my opinion to Mr. Mirto that I thought perhaps some of those churches hundreds of miles away should perhaps be quasi-independent from the Manila office, and if they wish to cooperate with and receive literature from and support the programs and the outreach of the Evangelistic Association, then they're more than welcome to do so. We have been able only to export a modicum of support to them, and most of that has been in the form of literature and tapes and materials. Very little of it has been in the form of money. We have not, of course, ever expatriated a single dime from the Philippines, and they have been basically a self-supporting work, and that's what I've always advocated for the Philippines, for Canada, for Jamaica, for South Africa, for England, for wherever we are organized overseas. So it is a work of preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God as a witness to the Filipino people, by the Filipino people, and to whatever extent we can help them, we certainly stand ready to do so. I'm scheduled at present to go through there about the first week in February and to proceed on down to at least three, I think maybe four stops in Australia. So I hope my voice holds out for that trip that is coming up. This morning when I went in to sit down and have my first cup of coffee, I picked up the U.S. News and World Report, the latest one for December 19, 1994. And lo and behold, on the cover is a picture, probably by Raphael, of the Madonna and child. In this case, the child looks like he is about 30. His head is almost the same size as his mother, but presumably he's only a few days old. Here's a woman here with a little tiny button of a mouth, not quite as white as her nose, with very sad eyes, look like she's in the throes of a very serious sickness of some kind. But that's the way a lot of the artists of the past envisioned Madonna and child. In a great, huge, bold capital letters, waiting for the Messiah, the new clash over the Bible's millennial prophecies. Now, do you people in this room essentially believe that there is a God? I think you do, or you probably wouldn't be here. What are you supposed to do about it? Well, obviously, run and hide. Right? Survive somehow. Do you believe the Bible is the Word of God? Well, I think most of you do. What are you supposed to do about that? run and hide. Go dig a hole. Get in a cave. Order a several years' supply of maybe hydrogen-packed grains and beans and foodstuffs so you can survive. Stock rifles, right? Concoct various scenarios as to when all this is going to happen. Do you believe Jesus Christ of Nazareth really lived? Most of you do. I think all of you do. You wouldn't be here. Do you believe, now we get really tough, that he is coming again? Do you believe what he said and that he meant what he said? And do you believe that his reporters, his listeners, who were his disciples, who were the eyewitnesses to his ministry, who wrote down what he said, names like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John come to mind, reported accurately what he said, and that he is going to do what he said? Now, as you go along answering these questions in your mind, I'm moving you further and further toward the lunatic fringe, according to some of these ultra-liberal publications and what they say. I would like to take you through a little bit of this because it may be far more important for us in the future than we think. When I think of the telephone call that our secretaries discovered on our tape-recorded messages in our letterbox the other morning, about 2 days ago, a voice of a man who said that you are a Jew organization and I'm coming for you. Well, we get that type of thing. A couple of years ago, somebody called one of our ladies here and said, there's a bomb and Garner Ted's going to die. Well, he's probably right about both. There probably are bombs somewhere, but I don't think they're intended for me, and probably eventually I am going to die, but not by him or his bomb. And if that were even allowed, of course, then that would be what God allows, and it doesn't matter one way or another to me. It's just whatever God has in store. But there are people out there in the world, both religious and irreligious, who come up with an incredible array of emotions and with agendas, and sometimes they take action. Now, I was also greeted this morning by another little tidbit in the news that for the second time in only a matter of a month and a half or so, someone has fired bullets at the White House. So within the last 6 months, we have had someone attempt to crash an airplane into the bedroom wing and to kill the Clintons. We've had someone conceal a little SKS semi-automatic Chinese-made rifle under his raincoat and try to kill them from across the street. Then we had someone else this morning, probably in the dark early wee hours here while we and Tyler were getting up and waking up from bed, shooting bullets at the White House. That, I think, underscores what I'm telling you. You and I live in a time of tempers gone berserk, of passions running very high, and a very great danger in society based upon what people think about you. People like to demonize different groups. They like to disparage them. They like to criticize them. They like to hang labels on them. They like to go after them. Well, here's this article, replete with some of the pictures of the great art of yesteryear. The Christmas Covenant. And it's the lead cover article of this issue of USNWR for today's date of December. Was Jesus' birth part of a divine plan leading to a golden age? Scholars are re-examining the biblical prophecies. The Advent season in church tradition is a time of sacred anticipation as Christians prepare to celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ some 2,000 years ago, and already they have that wrong. He wasn't born on December 25th. He was born in the autumn. But that's what they think, in a Bethlehem stable. For believers through the ages, the joy of Advent, meaning the arrival of Christ, lay in their understanding of that humble birth as a divine promise fulfilled, the swaddled baby in the manger as the long-awaited Messiah. For many Christians, the comforting images of the Christian season are inexorably linked to another more mysterious prophecy, that of the apocalyptic second coming of Christ. Apocalyptic. Now, you have to understand that this reporter hasn't the faintest idea what the word apocalypse means. A very ignorant man, most of them are. Most of you in this audience know that the word apocalypse means to reveal. Merely means an opening, a revealing, and it says in the very first words that it was that message which John was given from Jesus Christ to reveal to his servants. Well, they've taken the Greek word apocalypse, which merely means reveal or revelation, which is the English equivalent, and turned it into cataclysm, horrendous into the world cataclysm. So you got to read because the reporter's ignorant and didn't know any better. Cataclysm. Although Jesus is quoted in the Gospel of Matthew as saying no one will know the day or the hour of his return, the approach of a new millennium in the year 2000 is unleashing a flood of doomsday prophecies, not only from zealous Christians who are convinced that Christ's return is imminent, but also from those in cultural and religious settings far removed from Christian belief. Let me give you what they do reveal in an inset box. These are a result of recent polls. Of those who believe Jesus will return, the percentage who think he will come within, colon, a few years or a few decades, 34%. Those who think it will take longer than that, longer than even a few decades, 37%. Now that's of those who do believe he will return, which represents 61% of the population of the United States. 61% of our population believe that Christ will return, including Roman Catholics, but to them it is way out there in the distant future, decades and decades and decades, certainly not any time near right at the end of this century, which many other people think he will. Americans who believe the world will come to an end, 59%. How many of you think the world is going to come to an end? Don't raise your hand. I don't want you to make a mistake. Because this church does not teach that the world will come to an end. The church does not believe it will ever come to an end. The church believes that this world will endure for all eternity. But I mean the orb on which we walk in a completely different configuration, according to 2 Peter 2. When I say the end of the world, if we're reading the Bible, the Greek word was either aeon or cosmos, and it means age or orderly society or system. And the civilization, as we know it, is going to be dramatically altered. That has happened in the past, but never quite so dramatically altered as it's going to be at the time of the second coming of Christ. Now, Americans who believe the world will come to an end, and I think that most of them are ignorant of what I just explained to you, they really think it is going to be like the end of the world. Of these, the percentage who believe the end will occur within a few years, only 12%. Those who believe it'll take a few decades, 21%. Those who believe it won't happen short of a few hundred years, 16%. And those who think it is going to take longer than that, listen to this, 28%, the largest number, think it's going to be more than hundreds of years from now. Americans who believe the Bible should be taken literally when it speaks of a final judgment day, 60%. When the Bible speaks of the Antichrist, 49%. Think it ought to be taken literally. When it talks about the Battle of Armageddon, 44 out of 100, 44%. When it talks about the rapture of the church, same number, 44%. Believe in the rapture of the church. You know, no wonder Hal Lindsey's book was a bestseller. An awful lot of those people must have read it. And a lot of the mainstream churches, of course, teach the rapture, and I've had already some very irritated letters as a result of one of my recent television programs in which I told them there is no rapture. One woman was so exercised, and many people called and used some rather cryptic tones to our ladies who answered the telephone and told me that I was, you know, full of hogwash and very other polite expressions. That's why I was led the following week to talk about the one lady that was really exercised over it and said, "Lady, you know, if you want to have a rapture, go ahead and have one. Me believing you can't have one doesn't mean you can't have it, so go ahead and go through the roof. It doesn't matter. I can't take it away from you," I told her. "I cannot take away your rapture, because me believing it or not believing it doesn't alter anything, does it? I could devote my life to telling you the rapture is going to occur, and I could neither make it happen nor not make it happen." But I tell you something behind that kind of a call. It shows you that you've gotten under somebody's skin. And it's kind of like trying to keep your tongue out of that cavity. She was watching the next week. She couldn't stand it. So she probably got the message. Anyway, all right. Americans who believe some world events this century fulfill biblical prophecy, 53% of them believe that. Of those, the percentage who believe these specific events will fulfill prophecy, world wars, 16%. The conflict between Israel and its enemies, only 10%. The establishment of Israel in 1948, 6%. I'm surprised at that because you keep coming across that in literature from a lot of these groups, and they really seem to deal with a lot of chronology and a lot of scenarios about when the end time is going to be, and they base it upon a lot of chronology and so on from 1948. Or of these who believe that specific events fulfill prophecy and will result in something horrifying at the end of the world, the AIDS epidemic, 6% believe that that will contribute to the coming so-called apocalypse. Another interesting inset on the New Age, which is called the next plane of consciousness, and this is a growing movement in the United States, and there's a woman I'd never heard of before, but that's because I don't read that kind of literature, who has taken one name, I don't know whether her name was Gertrude Weinstein or what before, but her name now is Solara. I take it, if I look at the Latin, that means sunny, or sunbeam, or sunray, or of the Solus Invictus, Solara. And if all our institutions are falling, says Solara, there's a picture of her here, the single name she uses, but amid the chaos, a doorway she has helped open gives earthlings until December 31st, 2011. That's the date. December 31st, 2011, to step into the next dimension of consciousness. A lot of guys doing that already, just a little LSD on a sugar cube, but she says you gotta wait until 2011. If we fail, she warns, Earth could explode. You go out, you know, with a ditch digger, ditch witch, or a front-end loader, and you scrape around, look at all the mud and sand, you're wondering, what is it about it? It's going to blow up, but the earth could explode. Spoken by a popular leader of the growing New Age movement, of which a former movie star is a very key player and is incredibly popular, and I think has written about 5 books of her own, Shirley MacLaine, the millenarian message is taken seriously by many thousands. Solara has taught sold-out seminars around the world and written 5 books, 2 of which have brought movie offers. Her favorite answer to 20th century angst, that all of the problems, meaning the troubles, the pain, is that, quote, we are angels descended from the stars. I met a lady that used to be a German shepherd. But she says, we are angels descended from the stars. And this has sustained her own publishing house, Starborn Unlimited, and she pens a newsletter, The Starry Messenger, for 5,000 devotees. But Solara is best known for organizing the 11-11 event, a kind of sequel to the 1987 Harmonic Convergence, whatever that was. I guess it was a convention up in France and Missouri of 10,000 people that played harmonicas. I'm just kidding, but when more than 100,000 people prayed over a weekend for world peace. Boy, we've really had a wonderful time since 1987. It's been so peaceful out there. Rwanda has happened, Haiti has happened, the Somalia has happened, Bosnia-Herzegovina has happened, the Middle East crisis has happened, the bombing of the bus in Tel Aviv has happened, bloodshed, warfare, starvation, drought, famine, endemic disease, the threat of nuclear war, North Korea's saber-rattling and posturing, economic collapses, duress, angst, problems everywhere, but they prayed, 100,000 of them, for over a weekend for world peace. In 1992, convinced that the flash of 11-11 on digital clocks. Well, there goes mine. Anybody got a digital? I got to get rid of this thing. I've got a regular clock, and obviously, I'm not getting the full measure out of what I should from my timepiece. Because every time it goes 11-11, I ought to feel a bump in the road or something, at least, but it says here that the flash of 11-11 on digital clocks hold mystical significance. Tens of thousands of participants worldwide, and that doesn't mean what you might think it means, wore only white. And at 11:11 a.m., 11:11 p.m., and 11:11 Greenwich Mean Time on January 11th, aha, a really significant date, they performed dances she had designed. I can just imagine what it must have looked like. This drives me absolutely crazy. I'm sure it would have been wonderful. As a, quote, sign to those on high, they're dancing. So whoever they are, they're looking at, they're dancing. Now, Gertrude's got the step wrong. Forget that bunch. Let's wait till the next one to get it right. Anyway, they're down here and they're dancing so that the people on high will, quote, open the door. Now, that is a door. But when I walk outside and point up to the clouds, is that a door? There are some people that think that that's a door out there. So, her next move is, get ready for this, to sell her Charlottesville, Virginia home and go to French Polynesia to start a community of light. I wonder if eventually she will concoct a strange, maybe kind of a Polynesian fruit drink and lace it with arsenic and say it's time to become a beam of light. Line up, everybody. I would simply say to anyone who is thinking that they ought to sell their farm like she's going to do and go to French Polynesia and listen to her and learn her dance, make sure to take your digital watch, be awful careful. That may prove to be the end of the line for you. There's no telling what might happen. Now, the American Aboriginals, who are mistakenly called Indians, have seen something happen that I didn't know anything about. I just learned about it this morning, and I've got to pass it on to you. Have you heard? How many of you have heard about the white buffalo? Wow, go ahead. Well, look at that. Some of you people, where it hasn't been on the mainstream news, has it? How did I miss it? Has it been on? It's been on the mainstream news, and I missed it. Well, I rarely do that, so I just learned it this morning. It's showing a little white buffalo calf nursing at a great big ugly regular buffalo. Native American legends tell of a magical white buffalo woman who brought spiritual knowledge to a starving tribe, allowing its members to hunt buffaloes across the Great Plains. Now, says revered Oglala Lakota, that's a Sioux, medicine man named Floyd Hand, she, that is this buffalo woman, has returned and a great human reconciliation will occur. Others also think the birth of an all-white buffalo named Miracle last August has great meaning. More than 32,000 people have made a pilgrimage to Janesville, Wisconsin, even though the coat is now gradually turning brown and the white is gradually disappearing. Some wept as they adorned Miracle's fence with protective offerings of sage, tobacco. I never knew that that was a especially good offering. That might be a good use for tobacco. Just hang it on the fence. And small round nets called dream catchers. Round nets called dream catchers. In September, leaders from many tribes took the unusual step of consecrating the farm as holy land. The American Bison Association says that the odds against this birth are in the millions. But they cannot explain Hand's other prediction that the calf's father would die shortly after Miracle was born. And days later, the bull, which had seemed healthy, died. Of course, it makes me wonder where Hand was at the time, but that's neither here nor there. In spite of the attention, Miracle's owner, Dave Hyder, 45, says he won't charge admission or sell the animal, even after receiving an offer from rocker Ted Nugent, who I never heard of, but who wrote the 1974 hit Great White Buffalo. I didn't know there had been a 1974 hit all the way back then, 4 years before the creation of the CGI called Great White Buffalo. I'm not a churchgoer, Hyder says, but folks walk out of here like they've looked upon Christ. And what they've seen is a white buffalo. Well, I have marked up the article extensively, and I intend following up with an article of my own on the situation. But let me give you a few excerpts because I think it is important. They are rethinking popular views of the Second Coming. Some are openly challenging the imaginative end-of-the-world scenarios espoused by TV preachers and Bible teachers who view current events as fulfillment of end-time prophecies. Now, the scholars are descending upon their books, and they are taking a good hard look at anyone and everyone who would be espousing the idea that the Bible means what it says, Christ meant what he said, that the disciples took it down accurately, and that it remotely applies to the end time or the time in which we live, if those two are the same times. Their objections are sparking a debate that is sure to intensify and that could dramatically alter some popular views of the apocalypse. But belief in an apocalyptic end, read catastrophic, to history is by no means limited to the religious fringe. A new U.S. News poll has found that nearly 60% of Americans think the world will end sometime in the future. Almost a third of those think it will end within a few decades, and more than 61% say they believe in the second coming of Christ. They then go through the premillennialism, the amillennialism, and the postmillennialism. We no longer need poets to tell us it could all end with a bang or a whimper or in the agony of AIDS, explained Charles B. Strozier, a psychoanalyst and professor of history at the City University of New York. With the looming possibility of nuclear or environmental destruction, says Strozier, it now takes an active imagination not to think about human endings. Similar apocalyptic turmoil surrounded the year 1000. In an historical psychological study, the year 1000, Henry Folicon says artistic and cultural activity in Europe's monasteries nearly ground to a halt as the year 999 wound down toward what was widely viewed as an evening of the world. It was all going to come to an end because of an arbitrary date established by a guy that didn't know how to count, who arranged the Roman calendar way long ago, and that was supposed to have great significance. I have trashed I don't know how many publications. I've been getting them at the rate of sometimes one, sometimes two a day recently. One of the latest was, it showed exactly when the meteor was going to come by and how close, and even gave me a chart and showed the meteor going by in the world and had all the planes and angles, had the exact date and all of that, and I glanced at it, threw it away, and I'm sure it's going to hurt the gentleman's feelings from Australia who sent me that to tell me exactly how he had worked out the end of the world and how it was all going to come about. There are some people that actually think that I read that kind of thing and pay attention to it and faithfully watch television to see if I'm preaching what they told me I should. Indeed, the mystery and promise of the second coming of Christ have fired Christians' imaginations from their earliest days, often inspiring hopeful piety and artistic and theological creativity, but sometimes destruction and violence as well. Jesus is quoted in the Gospel of John as saying, "I will come again and receive you unto myself, so that where I am, there ye may also be." Most biblical scholars believe the first disciples were convinced Jesus would return in their lifetime. I believe that too. But I think it's obvious in the Scriptures that's what they thought prior to his death, burial, and resurrection. And it's what they thought even after he had convinced the unwilling witnesses who didn't really want to believe and said, "I will never believe," as Doubting Thomas said, until he forced them to believe. And even then they thought it's going to be imminent. It will happen in our lifetime, perhaps next month, next year, the Feast of Tabernacles, next Passover. When he did not, the church began developing a more detailed eschatology. Is that right? That's not the way I view it. Because that's saying that men, based upon a great disappointment, began to scramble around to explain it all. And that these uninspired men began to develop a more detailed scenario, or eschatology, meaning prophetic scenario, of how things would work out, which removes all the writings of the Bible from the time of the Apostle Paul onward, and places it into the area of profane literature, completely uninspired literature. Belief that the second coming was imminent pervaded early Christian writing, scholars note, but only Hippolytus of Rome, AD 170 to 235, tried to pinpoint the timing. So they've been busily trying to do that from way back, just this side of the death of Christ. He guessed AD 500 based upon the dimensions of Noah's Ark. Now, I don't know if you're aware that many people have decided that the dimensions of the Great Pyramid tell you a great deal about the time of the second coming of Christ. Other people, I suppose, look at the dimensions of county roads. I had one person tell me that he discovered Eden and sent me a map of Michigan and actually had all the little roadways and everything was all figured out and triangulated, and there was all kinds of algebra and calculus involved, and the center of the universe was there, and iron deposits, I don't know what all. One of the craziest things you ever tried to wade through, and so I didn't try. He guessed AD 500 based on the dimensions of Noah's Ark. Meanwhile, Augustine of Hippo, the preeminent theologian of the 4th and 5th centuries, argued against literal readings of prophecy and detailed speculation concerning Christ's return. His eschatological views were endorsed by the Council of Ephesus in 431 and set the tone for Roman Catholicism, which is not a detailed or a literal understanding of the Word of God at all, but the idea of a vague, eventual end of the world way out in the future somewhere. Even so, and despite Jesus' warning in Acts 1:7 that it's not for you to know the time and the seasons, the history of the church is filled, listen to this, with self-proclaimed prophecy experts. Is it ever? And it has never changed. And they are out there and I get literature from them all the time. Self-proclaimed prophecy experts who think they have cracked the biblical code and pieced together precise timetables for the end of the world. Now, I'll pause to mention to you once again, I was one of those. With both hands and both feet, I was in the middle of a very elaborate scenario that actually had it figured out. The Great Tribulation would begin in January 1972, based upon a concept of erroneous 19-year time cycles, fed to my father by a man whose both chronology and eschatology and history is extremely suspect. I began to realize in 1966, when the prophecies of the church, that the major intersections of freeways and so on would be so piled high with dead bodies of human beings in the throes of the second 7 years punishment to come upon the United States of America that a D9 caterpillar couldn't shove them out of the way. There were so many people lying around, the trains couldn't even run. That's what they thought. It's what I thought, what we thought, up until the early 1960s. I made a mistake. My wife and I and a group of other people went to Petra. When I looked at the scenes in Petra and looked at all of our teachings, and I went to the Middle East also, and I looked at Tyre, that was a mistake. And when I began to realize what really was going on in the Middle East, and then that great big huge banana-shaped Sikorsky helicopter of the Jordanian Air Force came clattering overhead, probably with King Hussein in it, and I was trying to do a radio program from the top of the Roman amphitheater overlooking many of the caves in Petra. And I got back, well, you know, all the tourists there, and I've described it before in a book and also in some articles, and I've told it out of the pulpit many times, so I won't belabor it. But with little Arab boys hawking the tepid soft drinks and a little guy that sold me a pair of cufflinks made out of an old Roman coin and all these things, and we rode in the seat, but other people were coming in the broad other end. And, of course, looking at the fact of mortars and their trajectory, at helicopters, at lasers, at H-bombs, at biological and chemical warfare, at flamethrowers, at all of these things, missiles, etc., of the modern panoply of weaponry available to the developed nations of the world, and then looking at the idea that a lot of horsemen were supposed to come down this narrow seek, and the earth was going to help the woman and close up and swallow up all the horsemen, and all the people of God would be protected in their caves. Well, I went back to Brickett Wood and made what my father said was one of the biggest mistakes of my life. And on the morning service of Atonement in 1966, I waded through the Word of God and gave the analogy of the Israelites in the land of Goshen who were protected by the blood of the Lamb on the lintels and doorposts of their homes in their own houses, and the death angel passed over, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even a million or two Egyptians were dying. Horrible plagues were descending upon cattle and man and woman alike, and the Israelites were spared from all of that and protected. I read the scriptures that talk about how Satan the devil at the last time is going to actually make war against the saints and prevailed against them in the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation and back in the book of Daniel where the same thing is stated. I looked at the fact of the concept of martyrdom that had been presented to the church for many, many years as the absolute proof of a secret double life or hidden sins, and that anyone who was martyred was guilty probably of the worst crimes and sins of all, so they would be left behind as the Laodiceans, who were lukewarm and probably not really even Christians, while the Philadelphians were going to be taken to a place of safety. Now, I know it's incredulous to you, but I have to report to you that as you sit there, there is quite a large splinter group that came from that original original organization that is split off, that still is believing and teaching that kind of thing to this day, and think they're all going to be taken to a place of safety, probably over to Petra in the Jordanian desert. So I stood up in a pulpit and preached it wasn't going to happen, and I proved it from the Bible. My father called me into his study in his home afterward, and he was so absolutely furious, he scared me so bad, I thought I was destroyed. I thought it was the end of my life, the end of my ministry. I was going to be kicked out of my home. Almost wish he'd have done it to me in 66. It would give me an awful lot of a head start beyond waiting until 78. But he was so blind furious with me that he just scared me half to death. And he went back right up in that pulpit and stood there and just thundered and pounded the pulpit. And to the woman were given two wings of an eagle that she might fly into the wilderness, and we're going to fly. And I'll tell you who was sitting in one of the front rows. Mr. and Mrs. Ron Dart. Ask him if I'm telling it the way it was. He terrified that church audience that day because he was going to stick to the scenario that the Great Tribulation was going to happen in 1972 in January. In the archives is a letter written by my dad which said in January 1972 that in reality, instead of bombs falling on New York and Los Angeles and Houston and Dallas, in reality, what really had occurred was that the greatest door in the history of the work had opened to the church. He was going to be able to put advertisements about our booklets in Reader's Digest. I'm sorry. You ask me, was my father a man of God? I say, definitely. I think so, through much of his life and certainly his early life. Did God use him? Absolutely. I have not the remotest shadow of a doubt that God used my father in many, many ways and for a long time. Was my father dead wrong about some of the prophetic scenarios and some of the things he believed? Absolutely. Just dead wrong. But if you dared to tell him you thought he was wrong, be ready for one of the greatest thrashings and tongue lashings and chewings out that any human being has ever had to endure. And I know whereof I speak. Now, I was the person who was out there, and I was the one who was supposed to espouse all the chronology. I was the person whom some of the creeps and the weirdos that couldn't even look in the eye and shake your hand in public, didn't even know how to function in society, were shoving into my dad's office, and maybe he was reading and this and that, but I'm the person that all the radio and television call-in talk shows came looking for. And I was unabashed and unashamed of what I believed. And I was unabashed and unashamed to field and to answer their questions by the dozens. And I've been in dozens of them in cities all over this country and in other nations around the world and had to answer their questions. Never forget one of the first ones up in British Columbia. He is there. There's a live audience of about 40, 50 people. The lights are on. Blink, the countdown, bang. Mr. Armstrong, are you a fraud? How would you like it? Now, just think about it for a minute. You're on live nationwide television. You've got a television talk show host who is there who has confused you with your father and lays at your door running all around the world. You've been around the world about a dozen times on a corporate jet. I never have been around the world on a corporate jet. I've only been around the world one time, and that at very great pain and suffering to even get the trip established. And then Mr. Dart went with me, as did Mr. McCullough and I think a couple of other people, and we went commercial. We went to Vietnam. And that was the only time I have ever been from point A to point B around the world. But he thought that was my, and I was meeting all the foreign dignitaries. And I think you've got me confused with someone else, and his name is Herbert. But anyway, he was taking me to task for being a member of God's jet set. So I was out there. I was having to field the questions and give the answers. It's awfully hard to do when you don't believe it yourself. It's awfully hard for me to stand out there and tell a vicious, angry, probing television or radio call-in host who has done his homework and has Martin's book about the cults and the Baptist books about Herbert Armstrong and Armstrongism and all the rest of it, and is asking all of these pointed and probing questions, for me to stand there and claim that I think that the United States is going to be bombed in January 1972 and that Christ is going to stand on the earth by the Feast of Trumpets 1975, and that it's based upon my father's conversion and baptism, that there were 119 year time cycles that lapsed between the time when the gospel was never being preached, and I didn't believe that. I didn't then, and I don't now. How could I explain what Christ said, that I will never leave you nor forsake you, and that the death or the grave will never prevail against the church, the gates of the grave will never prevail against it? How could I explain the Valdensians, the Petrobrusians, the Arnoldists? How could I explain the people during the days of Lollard? How could I explain that there were Christians in the Middle Ages who believed in the Sabbath? If I thought the gospel, which after all is the truth of God, and it does not embody only the message Christ brought, believe it or not, look at 1 Corinthians 15, the first six verses, it also embodies the message about Jesus Christ. No matter how many thousands of times my father said it is not a message about Christ, it is a message that he brought. It's both. You must preach in Jesus' name. You must preach his sacrifice. You must preach him as the Savior of the world. You must preach him as your soon coming King, your High Priest. You must preach his name. You must preach his birth. And you must appreciate it. You must preach his young life, his ministry, and everything that he went through in that life. So I have been part of an organization that years ago had to shed a lot of the very same kind of thing that I am getting in the mail almost every week. These people who write me these things expect me to adopt it, expect me to believe it and begin to preach it to you and to the world. And they expect that they are quite correct in what they have told me. Over the centuries, religious movements have risen and fallen on such speculation. A true statement? Absolutely. Absolutely. In the 1840s, for example, Baptist Bible teacher William Miller set four successive dates for Christ's return. He was wrong all four times. In recent years, we have heard of people, one was located out in Phoenix, and it was another organization that was on national radio and TV, that actually said the rapture was going to happen in 1987. Remember that? Then he had to write another book and said, no, I was wrong, it's going to happen in 1988. He didn't write one about 1989. I don't know what happened to him since that time. There's another man who left the WCG many years ago. I won't mention his name, but he really preached some really interesting things, like the way the demons got in the United States was aboard banana boats and banana republics, and they came up the Mississippi on the boats and the barges. That's the way they got into the hinterland. Anyway, he was a prophet, and he had a little following. He had such a following that there was a young man who became a multimillionaire. He and his wife in business, and this man was worth millions of dollars, as far as I know. And he gave up everything. Gave an awful lot of money to that man. The marriage broke up. His business went down the drain. He lost everything. I think he had to start up again all over again later. I don't know the whole story. But I remember that even people that used to work with me in the organization and worked on the staff of the Plain Truth magazine and even in the television studio were taken with this guy's teaching, and eventually, after years and years of every kind of a false scenario and a great disappointment and prophecy that just didn't work out, I guess he finally folded up his tent and quietly stole away. Well, where did that leave everybody? Now, let me tell you something that I still feel very pained about. Because during those days that we believed all of this, I was going up to Colorado every year to hunt with a gentleman, Mr. Walter Curtis, one of the nicest men I've ever known, and still is, and still a good friend, but he has gotten quite elderly and retired years ago, and I believe is living mostly in a mobile home. But it's very sad, because Mr. Walt Curtis went back up to the western slope of the Colorado Rockies, where his father had been a homesteader way back in the 1800s. And had built a little log cabin along Green and Service Creek that emptied down into a valley up there in Colorado, just the other side of Steamboat Springs. Walt was one of these people who was land rich and cash poor. He had what's called the Low Country Ranch way out the other side of Maybell, Colorado, and he had the High Country Ranch up there by the other side of Steamboat Springs. Well, finally, because of a prophetic scenario, and because of all the teaching and what he thought, and looking at hard times, and back then it was hard for sheep and cattle ranchers, he decided to sell that property and get out of there and come down to the college and work for us in our farm program. We all but begged him not to. I don't know if Mr. Dart was there at that time, but we were in his home, his son's home, I remember very well. Mr. McCullough was there, and several of us, and he was asking if he could just leave everything and come down to the college. Walt, don't do that. I'd seen other people leave businesses and coming to college to compete with their own sons. One man that had a fabulous big business down in South Texas, his son was in college, he decided to come to college. I didn't like it. I didn't like it then, I wouldn't like it now. Thought it was a bad decision, a very bad choice. Couldn't talk him out of it. So he sold that original ranch that his dad had sold, and then he had come as an older man and bought back and was raising a family up there in some of the most beautiful country you've ever laid your eyes on. Sold it for, I think, around $92,000. 1 year later, a big company came in, looked at all those mountains, and decided to build a ski resort. And the man who had bought it from Walt at $92,000 received a check for $1 million for his property. Walt and his wife ended up working for his own son, laying telephone cable, and now travels about to visit their children in a mobile home. You think that you don't think back about a church that espoused doctrines that made people make decisions based upon their lives and their children's lives, involving property, involving their entire future, that doesn't give you a gigantic pang of regret? It certainly does. Well, that's why I asked you at the beginning, you believe all these things, what are you going to do about it? What are we supposed to do? Let me just ask you a few questions. Is the Bible the Word of God? I believe it is. Did Jesus Christ mean what he said? He said. I believe he did. Did he die? Yes. He says he was, and I believe he was dead. Was he buried, and was he resurrected? Yes, I believe he was. Can you prove it? Look at Halley's Bible Handbook on the subject. That men don't go out and die. They're not sawn asunder. They're not crucified upside down. They're not thrown into lions for something they know to be a hoax. Did they spirit away his body? Well, that argument falls on its face because of what I just said. You don't become a martyr. Somebody eventually is going to break down and spill the beans. You can't have that wide of a conspiracy based upon your life and that kind of suffering. Did the Romans spirit away the body? If they had, they would have produced it. Did the Jews spirit away the body? If they had, they would have displayed it. Read the Halley's article on the many, many proofs of the resurrection, but read what Jesus Christ himself said and what the Bible says first. Yes, I believe all those things. Is the prophecy of Matthew 24, which is a step-by-step series of events that lead up to the second coming of Christ, true? I believe it is. I want to turn to that right quickly and give you just one example of something that is so easy to understand, and why it was read over and misinterpreted many, many years ago is difficult to really understand today. I won't read all the way up to it, but finally, after the wars and rumors of wars, the droughts, the famines, the earthquakes, and the preaching of the gospel and everything, he said in verse 15, when you therefore shall see. Now, I'm going to insert some words that people think are there. The striations on your package of bread at the checkout stand of the supermarket. When you shall see, GATT, WTO, in place. That's the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which will lead toward the establishment of the World Trade Organization, of which I am writing an extensive article right now, which is going to loom large as the greatest economic body in the history of the world, replacing the IMF and the World Bank, and will be telling the United States of America and calling the shots and telling us exactly what we're to do. And little nations like Togo, Ivory Coast, Cape Verde Islands, or Haiti will have a vote absolutely equal to ours. And once it is put in place, it will be to global commerce exactly what the Fed is to the American economy. But I am not a conspiracy theorist, I'm sorry, and I don't believe that the Trilateral Convention and David Rockefeller, Chase Manhattan Bank, and Citibank of New York are all ruled by a handful of free Jews in an attic over in Brussels who are keeping track of everybody on a computer. I really don't think that is true. So it doesn't say that to me. It says, when you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation. Now, I went back and read Daniel 9, 26 and 27, and Daniel the 12th chapter. And I can go back in my various Bible handbooks and history books and read how that was placed and set up at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, how it was done again in type by the armies of Titus, and how Jesus said it's going to happen at what he called the time of the end, just before the climax of the close of the age. What is it? We can understand what it is. The setting up of an idolatrous something, or even a human being who claims to be God, 2 Thessalonians 2, in a temple of God. Is it a real temple of God? It was when these words were written. It was when Paul wrote what he wrote. It was when Jesus spoke what he spoke. Is there to be a temple? This article from which I am quoting says that there are a lot of people who claim there will be. It even talks about a very large ranch in the Midwestern United States busily raising red heifers. It even talks about the Jewish organization that has got it all figured out right down to the last little bit of the vestments, and a man has been doing a lot of genealogical research to ferret out every Levite he can find that he believes is going to be called back to be a part of the priesthood. USN, United States News and World Report. I'm not talking about a lot of fictitious little, you know, cultic literature from someplace. I'm talking about an article that is today from one of the biggest, most respected news magazines in the United States, where people are painting that kind of a scenario. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, and a rejoinder is given parenthetically by Matthew, whoso readeth, let him understand. That's caution. Yellow light. Take time out. Really understand this. Then let them which be in Tyler, Texas, flee to Petra. Isn't what it says. Let them who be in Quilcene, Washington, flee to Petra. Let them who be in anywhere. No, it says Judea. What was Judea? Well, that was the Roman province of Judea in which Jerusalem was found. It was the capital of the Judean province where the Jews lived. Flee where? North, east, south, and west. In some cases, flee down. Down the mountains, because Jerusalem is up in the heights of the mountains. And you can go down toward the Dead Sea and find some of the most rugged mountains in the world, where an American evangelist got lost about a decade and a half ago and perished of thirst. And I've been by that area many, many times. I've been swimming in the Dead Sea a couple of times. My son Mark lived over there for the better part of 2 years. So I know the country very well. It says, let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains, plural. It does not say let people who are gathered in Big Sandy, Texas, go to Petra, does it? So how do we ever begin to believe that? It takes a lot of persuasion. It takes a magnetic personality. It takes a lot of very ambiguous scriptures which seem to say, if you put a certain spin on them, what you want them to say. It takes a lot of backslapping, a lot of accolades, a lot of building up of individuals who are supposed to really know history and supposed to really know chronology and supposed to really know eschatology and really know the Bible. They're supposed to be tutored and held up before the people as scholars. They're supposed to have IQs of 169 or 70. Supposed to be in the top 0.5% of the United States in intelligence. Supposed to be. And once you do it often enough, repetitively enough, and over the years and the decades, people begin to believe it. And they did. Now it says in verse 20, pray ye, who? Those that be in Judea. That your flight, who? Those that be in Judea. Be not in the winter. Oh, well then, you mean you don't know about it in advance? It says to pray, it's not in the winter. Well, if you know exactly when the comet is coming by, if you know exactly what chronology says, if you got the 19-year time cycles all figured out, you don't need to worry about the winter. You'll know exactly what the weather is supposed to be in Palestine in September of 1999, won't you? Of course you will. But there are people that are working busily right now, today, probably spending hours poring over their Bibles, preparing the next missive to send to me, and I'm going to get it on about Thursday or Friday of this next week. I'll show it. I should bring some of them. I've been showing them to my students, and they're amazed. I've taken them in. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll run down the hall and show you the one I'm talking about. So I did, I think, just the other day, and I showed them one. And it's just one of many that I get. For he says, then shall be great tribulation, such as was not from the beginning of the world of this time, no, nor ever indeed shall be. And then comes a description of the second coming of Jesus Christ. So, question. What should we, as the Church of God International, do? Here we are with the 20th Century Watch that has articles about the abomination of desolation, the building of the third temple, the second coming of Christ, the beginning of the millennium. What should we as a church do? Should we set dates? I say no. I will never do so, because my Savior tells me exactly what this article says. You cannot know of that day and that hour. Well, people argue he doesn't say you can't know the month. He doesn't say you can't know the year. I think his intent was you can't know the time. And I think that's very important, because if you knew even within 1 month, you would put off doing what you've got to do till that month began to start. And I think the intent of what Jesus meant was it will come on you unawares, and he says it over and over again, as it was in the days of Noah. So shall it be in the days of the coming of Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they bought, they traded, they sold, they married, and they gave in marriage, and they knew not until the very moment the disaster was upon them. So he says, be ye ready as men that are looking for the coming of their Lord. And he doesn't give you a time that you can depend upon from some kind of a scenario. Shall we publish elaborate charts and graphs and lay it all out so people can see how the Great Tribulation, how the captivity of Israel, how the ministry of the two witnesses, how the building of the temple in its duration, how the time of the reigning of the beast and the false prophet, and the Antichrist claiming that he is God in the temple of God, how it all works out on paper, and have an elaborate graph and a chart so you can look at it and you can really depend upon that? Not me. 1954, I was putting that kind of stuff just as confidently as any young man could on the blackboard. Here's the second coming of Christ, represented by a line down the blackboard. Here's an arrow leading up to it. That's the end of the ministry of the two witnesses. Here's an arrow leading below that. That is the time Israel is in captivity. Here's an arrow. That's the time of the Gentiles trotting down the holy place. It was all there. And the students are taking it down, and to this day, in Bibles and in charts and graphs and old notebooks are all kind, a scenario says 1972. How dumb, how absolutely stupid, how fallacious, how naive we were in those days. Shall we stockpile arms? What for? Who are you going to shoot with them? Well, they did down here in Waco. Now, I know that the BATF was incredibly, not only inept, but criminally irresponsible, in my opinion, Janet Reno and her troops. I think that's a terrible tragedy. I was just told today, or yesterday, or whenever it was, that somebody has come along and been interviewed who is going to stand in as the next heir apparent to David Koresh and continue their thoughts and beliefs. I don't know when the next... I thought that Armageddon was over when that place burnt to the ground with those poor children inside, but somebody's coming along, and no doubt there will be saps and suckers, as Liddy calls them, who will follow this poor person and probably to their deaths. Did you hear a few months ago, only a few weeks ago, about the mass suicide pact in Switzerland, and I believe in Canada, of people who took their lives? Because if they can't make Russia do something, if they can't make Russia invade Israel, they can at least drink some arsenic. I mean, if that's religion, please, dear God, let me be 10,000 miles away on the other side of the earth and not even hear about these idiots. I don't want anything to do with that kind of religion, yet I get telephone calls of stupid people who try to link me together with the likes of a David Koresh. And that's disturbing, because I believe in a Sabbath, because I reject the doctrine of the Trinity, and because I believe there isn't going to be a rapture. For some reason, that is dangerous to some people, and there are lots of folks out there who would just love to put a couple of bullets right here in this fleshly heart of mine. It's beating away whether I am aware of it or not. Should we stockpile arms? Well, I mean, just how many rounds of 50 caliber ammunition do you think it would take before they wheeled up a tank and blew you away? How long are you going to last? Should we stockpile preserved foods and have enough to supply? Well, how long would you like to exist in this world once the tribulation is coming down around your ears? One more month? Would that be fun? Been a lot of fun for the grandchildren. One more month while the war goes on, right? Let's exist. Let's subsist. Let's survive. Let's dig holes. I went on Oprah Winfrey show, and I was sitting there with a lady who was up in Maine in some rainy forest up there, digging holes in the ground, and lived in a dugout with a herd of buffalo. You know why she did? She said the buffalo survived all attempts at its annihilation. And the buffalo is a survivor. So we have buffalo up there, and we're going to survive. All these people, and I was asked on that program, brethren, because I was viewed as just as much a wacko as those people sitting next to me. That's the only reason I was on that show. I was viewed as an absolute wacko sitting there with a woman who's digging holes in the ground intending to survive. Well, should we sell everything and move to Alaska, or better yet, the French Polynesia? No. Should we all buy a digital watch and wait for 11/11? No. Should we set an exact time? And it's always good to wait on the rooftop. That kind of helps the head and the shoulders in case, you know. And you want to be sure to be dressed all in white. Now, that would present a problem for you housewives who don't really know the difference between tide and sheer. You want to get them really white. Should we then eventually, if we're down there, drink orange juice laced with arsenic? because that would be one way to meet the end of the world. It'd sure be the end of your world, wouldn't it? Or shouldn't we do this instead? Should we instead believe this word as the Constitution of the United States gives us a free right and privilege to do? Preach it as we see it, and live as good and decent and godly a life as we can, loving our neighbors and even our enemies. Should we instead work hard and live life like it will be going on forever, because we believe our Savior who said, "Blessed is that servant whom when his Lord shall come, he shall find so doing." Christ says, "Don't set dates." Yes, Lord, I'm not about to set dates. He says, "You can't know the day and the hour." Yes, Lord Jesus Christ, I cannot know the day or the hour. So don't pretend, Garner Ted, like you think you know pretty close to other people as a kind of a hook to get them to come and follow you, send you their paycheck, and send you their money. Don't deceive them by making other people think you know pretty close to when he's going to come. Because I don't. And I don't know if he's coming in 1999 or 2004 or 2017 or 2037. I don't have the faintest idea. I do know that he says, "When you shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place where it ought not. Then let them which be in Judea flee," because trouble is going to be kind of localized there in that imminent event. Doesn't tell me to flee if I'm in Tyler. I'll probably read about it in the USNWR. I'll probably see it on Nightline or something, or on television. I'll say, "Oh, they're doing it. There it is." Doesn't tell me to flee. It just tells me to keep preaching. Keep doing what you're doing. Just put one foot down in front of the other and keep doing the work of God. Shouldn't we live life like it's going to be going on forever? And shouldn't we be found when all of these events happen, when they happen, not if, but when they happen, to be those servants of whom Jesus will congratulate when he says through the prophet Daniel, "Blessed are those who turn many to righteousness, for they shall shine like the stars forever." Shouldn't we be found instead of digging holes in the ground and coming up with prophetic scenarios, simply doing the work?